ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, a Senate inquiry hears Optus held 11 crisis meetings before revealing the 000 outage deaths. Also, should Australia be sending minerals to China for use in weapons? And straight to the point, the sewing community sharing patterns and fighting fast fashion.
I've definitely noticed there's a lot more people getting into sewing, especially after COVID. I think it was a time that did spark a lot of people looking for creative outlets and hobbies and things to do during that time. And there's definitely also this rising awareness of the slow fashion movement.
First tonight, is the Coalition at risk of another split over net zero? The Nationals' decision to dump their commitment to net zero emissions by 2050, just 4 years after signing up to it, has piled renewed pressure on the Coalition partnership and caused more turmoil within the Liberals and focus on the leadership. National Affairs correspondent Jane Norman joined me earlier from Parliament House. Jane, what's been the fallout from the Nationals' decision yesterday to dump net zero?
Well, I think the fallout has largely almost been on the Liberal side because it is now firmly in focus. What does the Liberal Party do? What does this mean for Susan Lee? What does this mean for the future of the Coalition? So the Nationals on Sunday leapt ahead of their Liberal counterparts and unilaterally dumped their commitment to the net zero emissions target by 2050. It was just 4 years ago that they signed up, but 4 years later we have them withdrawing their support for this commitment. Now, Susan Lee, as Liberal leader, has put in place a process to review all of the Liberal Party's policies, and the biggest one is really the commitment to net zero and their energy policy. So that is still ongoing. So the party still doesn't really have a position on this. And so all day the questions have gone to Liberal MPs, where do you stand? And at this point in the day, there is a very clear divide. The party has splintered along factional lines. You have the moderates who want to win back urban seats. It should be noted that the Liberal Party at the moment hold around about 9 of 88 urban seats. Their path back to power goes through those seats. And the moderates believe that they need to show that they believe in climate change, believe in action on climate change, and therefore need to stay signed up to this target of net zero emissions. Interestingly, it does look like the moderates are open to watering down the commitment, but ultimately want to keep that net zero target. Then you have the conservative side, and it looks like at this stage the conservatives are sort of gaining momentum in their desire to dump the net zero commitment. And we've heard MPs from Melissa McIntosh, Sarah Henderson today adding their voice to calls to dump the net zero target. They have directly linked it with rising power prices. It's a very contested area, but they say that net zero policies are leading to rising power prices. Therefore, the party should get rid of it. So it's a lot of chaos and turmoil within the Liberals.
And Jane, is there any sense of how long this will run? Would they be waiting for the outcome of their policy review, or do you think something's going to happen more urgently?
I think something is going to happen more urgently. In fact, we're just hearing late this afternoon that the leadership group, which involves obviously Susan Lee, her senior Liberal MPs, have now determined that this question of net zero must be resolved within weeks. We're hearing that it will be resolved by the time Parliament rises, or at least the House of Representatives rises at the end of November. And really, it's to cauterise the bleeding. The policy review process was going to run anything between 6 and 9 months, but there is now a real urgency to resolve this question. I'm hearing, and I must caveat this by saying that there's still a little way to go, but I'm hearing that the momentum appears to be building for the party to dump net zero. And part of the reason for that is that Susan Lee, who is a moderate, who in another world would really be supporting net zero, is looking out for her leadership and the need, the desperate need to keep the coalition together. So it's a bit of a watch this space, but as the day draws to a close, that is where the Liberal Party is at.
That's National Affairs correspondent Jane Norman at Parliament House. A Senate inquiry into Optus's 000 failures has found the company held multiple crisis meetings before telling the government three people had died. Chief Executive Stephen Rue acknowledged the failure, but insisted he's the right man to fix the issues. Now those affected by the outage are being urged to speak with the inquiry. Kimberly Price reports.
An intense grilling in Parliament House.
Surely the job as a telecommunications company that has failed to deliver the most basic service of 000 is to tell the government by which gives you the licence. But of course, it took you hours to do that.
Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young confronts Optus Chief Stephen Rue on what he did on September 18, the day his company suffered catastrophic 000 failures, which resulted in the deaths of three people. The hearing heard Mr. Rue learnt of the deaths almost 12 hours after they first became known. It would take him another 6 hours to inform Communications Minister Annika Wells.
It was important.
But you weren't doing the welfare checks, Mr. Rue. You had other people doing that. What were you doing? Why hadn't you called the government and told them what was actually going on?
I was in a series of meetings with my team.
After the Coalition and the Greens teamed up to fast-track the Senate inquiry into September's deadly outage, a timeline of events have been made public. The first 000 call failure occurred just after midnight on September 18 and less than a minute after the firewall upgrade. By 8:43pm, the first death became known to Optus, but that information was not passed on to the company's senior management team until 25 minutes past midnight. Mr. Rue would not learn of the three deaths until 8:13am on September 19.
We absolutely should be able to quickly identify a 000 outage. Call centre staff should be trained to escalate any mention of 000. And we should have the capability to assess data and undertake the welfare checks faster.
Stephen Rue informed the telecommunications regulator, the Australian Communications and Media Authority, at 2:30pm on Friday, September 19, and phoned the communications minister around 4pm. The public wasn't made aware of the 000 failure until a media conference held after 5pm. Despite the delays in Optus's response, Mr. Rue has defended his job.
But I firmly believe that another change of leader at this time is not what Optus needs or what our customers need.
Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson says the delays are unacceptable.
The CEO sat on his hands and for many hours didn't inform ACMA, the regulator, and the minister's office about the true scale of the catastrophe.
Toby Murray, a professor at the School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne, believes the outage was worsened by senior management failing to recognise that there was a problem.
And that means it took many hours, you know, for the gravity of this situation to be understood by people senior enough at Optus to, you know, be putting in place the sorts of measures to get the situation under control.
While Optus has confirmed they are recruiting 150 people as part of an overhaul of their call centre procedures, Toby Murray says the Senate inquiry can interrogate the telco's governance to ensure this won't happen again.
My hope is very much that those questions around process and culture can be probed here so that we can understand not just how this could have been avoided on the day, but how it can be avoided in the future.
Running alongside the Senate inquiry, Optus has appointed former NBN director Kerry Schott to lead an independent review into the outage. And the regulator ACMA is also investigating the incident, which Toby Murray believes should make concrete recommendations for the sector's processes. And he wants those recommendations made public.
I really think that transparency is key here. So the public has got confidence that those recommendations have been adopted as well.
The Senate inquiry will probe other telcos, government agencies and the Minister of Communications, Annika Wells, in the days ahead.
Kimberly Price. The Australian government is being urged to develop a more detailed and transparent China strategy amid renewed focus on competing trade and security issues. A Four Corners investigation has found Australia is providing China with a mineral crucial for its nuclear programs and hypersonic missiles. The Resources Minister has today told Parliament Australia is committed to changing the global supply chain monopoly of critical minerals. Diana Damjanovic reports.
Australia is the biggest supplier of zirconium to China. The critical mineral, found in its raw state around the country, is being dug up and increasingly finding its way into Chinese high-tech weapons. Federal Defence Minister Richard Marles admits that presents an awkward challenge when it comes to balancing Australia's security needs with its reliance on China's economy.
China is our largest trading partner on the one hand, and it is our biggest source of security anxiety on the other. And it's just, that is the way the world is.
And how it's set to stay, with the Defence Minister rejecting the need for tougher export controls on Australia's critical minerals. During question time today, the government stayed firm on its critical minerals ambitions, pointing to an $8.5 billion deal recently signed with the US. Madeleine King is the Minister for Resources and Northern Australia.
This Australia-US framework is now the model for all US engagement around the world, and together we are leading the way.
The Resources Minister insisting Australia is committed to changing the global supply chain monopoly of critical minerals and rare earths. Currently, China controls about 90% of the global processing and production capacity of rare earths.
This government has done the hard work to develop policy in critical minerals and rare earths, and will continue to do this work to ensure the future of the critical minerals sector and the critical minerals and rare earths processing industry of this country.
The ABC's Four Corners program has revealed that Chinese companies are the largest shareholders in two Australian mines producing minerals for Beijing's military build-up. Greg Jericho is the chief economist with the Australia Institute. He says balancing of trade and geopolitics is a delicate act.
If we're going to be stopping our mineral sales because we're concerned about where they might end up, that's going to require a very big change in foreign policy and trade policy.
But there are those who believe it's a dilemma that must be confronted. Rory Medcalf is the head of the National Security College at ANU.
The government has this three-point mantra about China. We agree where we can, we differ where we must, we always act in the national interest. That's fine, but it needs to be elaborated in a much more detailed and transparent China strategy that explains precisely where risk is concentrated in the relationship.
That's the head of the National Security College at ANU, Rory Medcalf, ending that report by Diana Damjanovic. This is PM. I'm Annie Guest. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Coming up, the effort to prevent frequent power disconnections for remote Indigenous communities. For many, the cost of visiting a GP has been rising, with out-of-pocket fees making much-needed healthcare unaffordable for some people. Now, sweeping changes to bulk billing have come in, allowing more patients to see their doctor without paying a gap fee. While patients welcome the change, doctors warn the nearly $8 billion package may not have the impact the government is hoping for. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Tamara lives near Nubina, about an hour's drive south of Hobart, in an area where bulk billing GP practices have been virtually non-existent.
Several times I have done a thorough ring around looking for a bulk billing practitioner, and there has been none.
The Tasmanian woman knows she needs regular medical treatment to manage her multiple sclerosis, but she can't afford the out-of-pocket costs. Instead, she goes without.
I just generally don't go. When I used to have regular blood tests, pathology, that sort of thing, now I just don't do it because I don't want to pay $100 for a simple pathology request.
But Tamara's access to healthcare might be set to get easier, with a regional GP clinic near her home switching to universal bulk billing.
Yay! Wow, that's amazing. Fantastic. I'm there.
The move by Nubina's Tasman Medical Practice means patients registered with Medicare will no longer need to pay additional private fees to see a doctor.
It's quite exciting because it does remove that barrier. It's like a safety net.
The practice had already been bulk billing many of its patients, but GP John Saul says new incentives introduced by the federal government mean no one misses out.
It makes sense at Tasman because it's a tough area. There's a lot of retired people. There's quite a few low-income people, quite a few people with complex health needs who can't work. So with large numbers there, simple economics means there's benefit in universal bulk billing.
The federal government promised the $7.9 billion Medicare package at the last election. The changes have now come into force and they allow GPs to receive a bulk billing incentive for any patient rather than just concession card holders and children. And there are additional incentives when all GPs at a clinic bulk bill every patient they see. The government has promised that 9 out of 10 GP visits will be bulk billed by 2030. Dr. Saul is also a spokesman for the Australian Medical Association, which believes the federal government is overestimating the number of clinics that will make the change.
In my opinion, the numbers just won't reflect what the government are telling us. It just isn't going to be beneficial for all practices to move over to universal bulk billing. We at the AMA feel that there are better ways to use this money.
The Tasman medical practice is in the Tasmanian electorate of Lyons, represented by Assistant Health Minister Rebecca White.
What we know across the country and even in Tasmania is that we are seeing practices from both the city and regional areas sign on to this incentive to provide full bulk billing services. We have about 7,000 GP practices across the country, around 1,500 already bulk bill, and as of this weekend, another 1,000 have moved to bulk billing.
She argues the investment will gradually win over more general practitioners.
The model has been designed to recognise the work that our GPs are doing, to reward them for that work, and to recognise when they move to fully bulk billing. That's better for patients, but we can also financially incentivise them too.
That's Assistant Health Minister Rebecca White and Alexandra Humphreys reporting. As summer approaches, remote communities across Australia are bracing for soaring temperatures. But a landmark study has found vital power to these First Nations households is being shut off at alarming rates. Advocates want the government to intervene, saying disconnections are putting lives at risk. Indigenous Affairs reporter Chris Flanders prepared this report.
In Antibar Town Camp in the Northern Territory, kids play with a garden hose as they try to keep cool. But when temperatures push 40 degrees, reliable power is vital.
It's really hot.
It hot,
and sometimes inside here, it's really hot. That's why we put the aircon on. Like sort of all day.
All night. Makes a lot of power.
That's Judy Peters and her partner Nicholas Kunoth. Their power used to get disconnected, forcing them to take a 6-hour walk to town to purchase credit from a shop. Keeping the fridge on was their main worry. It's needed to preserve Judy's life-saving insulin medication.
Yeah, I take water and probably a shirt to cover my head over. It's really hard without car and no power and all the hot day weather.
Less than a year ago, the power supplier changed their plan for medical reasons to ensure they'd never be disconnected again. But the couples now realised they can't afford to keep all their appliances running and they owe more than $1,000. For most remote communities across Australia, prepaid plans are the only option provided by their energy retailers.
So, on here, if you want to find out how much, if the friendly credit come in, you press B.
Community members have opened up about their struggles to senior researcher Vanessa Davis. She's a Western Arrernte woman who grew up in Imungana and her house is powered under the same plan. She says hearing the stories broke her heart.
It's really sad. It's really sad. You know, they find it hard to keep up the power. And there's people with chronic illness had to have the power and to keep their body temperature cool.
These experiences have been revealed in a landmark report launched in federal parliament today. It's found almost 9,000 households on prepayment plans are impacted by frequent disconnections. On average, that's 30 disconnections a year. Lauren Mellor from Aboriginal organisation Original Power is the report co-author.
We had good collaboration from 4 of the 5 retailers in Australia using prepayment, so we had unprecedented access to data looking at the disconnection rates. What we found across the Northern Territory was pretty stark. Communities are dealing with, on average, 59 disconnections per household per year. Roughly once a week, families are disconnecting, and that can happen in extreme heat where you've got temperatures over 40 degrees for weeks at a time.
The report says the disconnections are affecting food security, health, well-being and economic participation for First Nations prepayment customers. It's made a range of recommendations to keep residents connected, including improved access to renewable energy and better reporting by retailers.
Now we need to see those state and territory and federal governments that are in charge of our energy regulation in Australia actually step up and look after prepayment customers in the same way that they do when we have other energy customers in Australia struggling to pay and keep their energy connected.
In a statement, Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen said he appreciates the report and is working with communities to get fairer, better deals out of their energy retailer. A spokesperson for NT provider Power and Water said First Nations customers can now use a dedicated helpline and are encouraged to better understand how to use less power, keep their meters topped up, and use emergency credit to avoid disconnection.
Chris Flanders reporting. With same-day delivery of clothes just a couple of clicks away, you'd be forgiven for thinking sewing machine ownership might be a thing of the past. But there's a growing community of young people stitching away in a fight against fast fashion and landfill. Elizabeth Cramsey has this report.
Today I made the Rosebud Raglan Top from Sew It Yourself.
Daisy Braid makes sewing tutorials for her online followers. She's known as DIY Daisy, famous for her colourful and size-inclusive designs.
I adjusted the pattern formula, multiplying the arm bust measurement by 1.5.
I think the sewing community is one of the most friendly and welcoming and encouraging communities that I've ever been a part of, and that's why I wanted to be a part of it originally. So I actually started sharing back in 2016, and originally I was just sharing my outfits and things that I had made, but then I just felt like I wanted to contribute to it, and so I started sharing tutorials.
She's created an online community of 92,000 people passionate about slow fashion and sustainability.
There are people that still make a lot, and there's this like, I guess this like need to constantly have something new. But for me, sustainability is one of the main reasons I sew, and also just being part of the process and knowing that where I'm buying my fabric from, it's dead stock fabric, or it's coming from the op shop, or I'm buying from places that have transparent production when they're making their fabric.
And it's part of a wider revival of sewing as more people take up the age-old craft. The page has grown steadily since 2022 when she released Sew It Yourself, a book teaching beginners how to sew their own wardrobes without the need for a pattern.
There is just so much joy and positivity that comes out of like being able to express yourself and be able to make something from scratch. The indie pattern companies have been coming up so much lately because the big four pattern companies have all like kind of closed in the last couple of years. So there's really been that need for patterns, modern patterns, and patterns that are made for different kinds of bodies and all different types of people.
Once upon a time, sewing your own clothes meant going to the shops and purchasing a paper pattern from one of the big four companies, Vogue, Butterick, McCall's, and Simplicity or New Look. But the parent company of those labels was sold to a liquidator earlier this year. Another passionate sewist creating content online is Felicity Dung.
I definitely have the same memories of, you know, going to Spotlight or the op shop and getting the paper patterns, and they were kind of, you know, really confusing. Or learning all the language was like another language in itself. But I think there has definitely been the rise of digital patterns, which has made it a bit more accessible for people. The language is a bit more accessible, and you can also just print them off at home.
Welcome to Mend It Monday, where I finally get to this box of all the things I say I'm going to fix and I actually do it.
Her page, Good Thread Studio, has almost 20,000 followers on Instagram. She says supporting the original designer or pattern creator is much easier now.
I mostly look for independent pattern designers, so that's a lot from Etsy or finding the patterns off Instagram usually. So I'll usually get those patterns, digital patterns, and print them off and go from there.
Felicity Dung says her popularity is being driven by a younger, climate-conscious cohort.
This rising awareness of the slow fashion movement, and I think that comes from awareness of how detrimental fast fashion is in terms of the impact on the planet as well as people. people and from a human rights perspective. So I think there's definitely that way into sewing from a sustainability perspective. And especially, I think, in the younger generations, that's definitely becoming more prominent.
That's sewer Felicity Dung ending that report by Lizzie Cramsey. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Annie Guest. The podcast of the full PM program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night. Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For months, there's been great hope of a November interest rate cut to coincide with the Melbourne Cup. But now, with inflation rising again, all bets are off. What have the three rate cuts already granted this year done to house prices? Today, finance expert Alan Kohler on why the only way is up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.